Well, we're sort of working backwards here. The last session dealt with how to understand Jesus in light of Paul. So we're dealing with how Jesus relates to someone who followed him. But now we're going to ask the question, how does Jesus fit in relationship to Judaism? That it was in the very frame and context in which he was preaching, something that in one sense preceded him in his ministry. But it's an important question because some of the tension that Jesus' ministry ended up producing came because of how he related to Second Temple Judaism, and particularly some of the tradition that had built up around Second Temple Judaism in terms of its pursuit of faithfulness for reasons that we traced in an earlier session. Remember that in the context of Second Temple Judaism, there was an emergence of a desire to become a more faithful kind of follower of the covenant, because of the pressure of the influx of Hellenism and the fact that some people were acclimating, some Jews were acclimating their lifestyle towards Hellenistic influences and losing their distinctives. This led to a raising up and a raising up of the centrality of certain distinctives and emphasizing the participation in those distinctives as a way of marking out oneself as Jewish and showing your ethnic and commitments and your ethical commitments in the process to the way of God. Well, how did Jesus deal with this backdrop? The way it's often portrayed is the way Jesus dealt with this backdrop is that he changed Judaism and dealt with legalism. And there are elements of truth to that portrait, but I want to think about it in a slightly different way. What I think Jesus did in relationship to Judaism, and particularly these covenant emblems that we're talking about, is that he intensified the Torah in the way he went about calling people for the way to live. Perhaps nothing shows this as powerfully as the distinctive features that are a part of the Sermon on the Mount, where the structure of what's called the six antitheses run in this kind of a way. You have heard it said, but I say unto you. Now, as an aside, there's a Christological thing going on about this that's very, very important. And that is the way in which Jesus juxtaposes his own authority and his own reading of the Torah with the way in which it has traditionally been handled. You've got to sit back and ask, who gets to play with the Torah like that? Who has the right to play with the Torah like that? And there's a Christological implication about who Jesus is, that he feels comfortable with, if I can use a phrase that alludes to a movie, with fiddling with the Torah, okay? He is the fiddler on the roof playing with the Torah, but the way he's doing it is to intensify it as opposed to walk away from it. So we get the emphasis of, you have heard it said, but I say unto you, and so what you get is a discussion of murder, and Jesus says murder isn't the issue, anger is. You get a discussion of marital fidelity and of adultery. And he says, adultery isn't the discussion, lust is. You get the discussion of oaths. Saying yes or no to an oath isn't the issue, integrity is. Let your yes be yes and your no be no. You get the contrast between hating your an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth, and the call is to love your enemy, those kinds. So what you're getting is an intensification of the Torah. You're asking the question, not what is the external standard that the law addresses in its proposition that says you can go this far but not any further. It rather is a look at where the heart is in relationship to what that standard is, thus intensifying what the Torah is about. This is a very important ethical thrust in Jesus' teaching. It's part of the wisdom Jesus that we were talking about before, but it also puts Jesus in an interesting frame of reference in terms of his Jewish background and the way in which he's handling Judaism and the way in which he's reading these texts. Now, if you think about this, you can actually see this in other areas to some degree as well. And so when we think through the way in which the nation handles its materials and the different distinctives that we're talking about. The distinctives that we're talking about are Sabbath, food, nation, temple, Torah, land, and return. Those are kind of the areas that deal with the issue. The last one, the issue of land and return, is the idea of we may be in the land, but we're waiting for God to bless our people, to bring his righteousness. With regard to Sabbath, the issue Jesus raises, you know, is it right to do good on the Sabbath or not? He was raising the question about how people are treated on the Sabbath as a justification for the kind of Sabbath healings that he was engaged in that the leadership objected to. He engaged in the idea that somehow the disciples plucking grain as they're walking down the road on the Sabbath is not a violation of the Sabbath because of what I would call not only the intensification of the Torah, but a relational dimension to the way in which the Torah is to be applied so that you understand why it is that certain things that Jesus does on the Sabbath fit within the way the Sabbath should be handled. Jesus doesn't teach, oh, I don't care about the Sabbath, it's not a special day. He says things like, what more appropriate day to do this? And so what we're seeing is not the raw statement of a principle proposition that rules out the relational dimensions of what's going on with God's law, but we see an emphasis on the relational dimensions in such a way that God's law functions appropriately. Now, there's a Christological aside to this that's pretty important, and that is, who has the right to fiddle with the law? I can use the picture of the fiddler on the roof. Who has the right to fiddle with the law? Who has the right to play with the law? This actually makes a Christological point. The law comes from God. He's responsible for giving it. He's the one who's responsible for the distinctives that are a part of it. So what does it say about Jesus' authority that he can say things like, you have heard it said, but I say unto you. This emphasis on his authority to make judgments about the law is important. In fact, in one of these disputes that I've just cited, the plucking of grain, the punchline at the end is, and the Son of Man is Lord of the Sabbath. Okay, who can be Lord of the Sabbath? And with this kind of a category, we're introducing something into the historical Jesus discussion that's important to realize, and that is that Jesus is pushing the ceiling from the earth up with this kind of an affirmation. He is saying, I have been given authority over the Sabbath. Well, the Sabbath is the Lord's day. The Sabbath is God's day. So if he has authority over God's day, what does that say about who he is? That's the point that we're dealing with here. And we're going to see several features in the life and ministry of Jesus that push in this direction. Because Jesus spent much more time showing who he was than talking about who he was. What his deeds indicated pointed to his authority and helped to underscore the nature of his authority and help to reveal the scope of his claims as much as anything that he said. Something not very appreciated, particularly about the Synoptic Gospels, because again, we're so used to John's Gospel, where in certain places, Jesus just says it straightforward by what he says. But in the Synoptics, the way we get our hands around who Jesus is by what he does and by what those actions represent in the way in which he does them. That's what we're seeing with the Sabbath. With regard to food, he emphasizes not the issues of ritual cleanliness and uncleanliness with regard to food, saying that it isn't what you put in your mouth and what comes out the other end that it determines clean and unclean, but it's what comes out of the heart that determines clean and unclean. He's intensifying the Torah, and he's giving the Torah its relational base in terms of thinking about the way in which it works. When it comes to the temple, there's not one place where God is present and one place where God worships, but God is going to be present, is present everywhere, and he's going to be present within his people, and he's present within me. So that the Spirit now, in a sense, you could say, the Shekinah now dwells individually in people so that, in Pauline language, we become the temple of God. So all these things represent the intensification of the Torah. It isn't a rejection of the law. In fact, in Matthew, Jesus says before he gets to the antitheses, I've come to fulfill the law, not to do away with it. But the way in which he fulfills the law is not by a kind of wooden literalism that simply deals with the proposition. The way he fulfills the law is to ask the question, where is the law trying to go in terms of the heart? Where is the law trying to go in terms of the way I relate to other people and the way I view my relationship to other people? And when you see the ethic this way, you actually see how it drops into that kingdom discussion that we had earlier, that the call of the kingdom is to be a certain kind of person and to live in a certain kind of way and reflect a certain set of virtues and characteristics that reflect the character of God. The kingdom of God is about manifesting the presence of God, and that presence is manifested when we reflect His character and live out our lives in light of the image with which He made us, which is designed to be a reflection of who He is. All this comes together in the way Jesus is teaching and preaching with regard to the Jewish background. So even though He's reconfiguring to some degree what's going on in the Jewish background, it's not a rejection of the Jewish background as much as it is an enhancement and an elaboration and an exposition of the Jewish roots and what makes the walk with God distinctive among the people of God. So this is a key characteristic of Jesus' life and ministry. We're going to see many points where He challenges the authority or presents His own authority by challenging the authority of the Jewish leaders. Another scene where this happens is the healing of the paralytic. It's like the Torah scene in terms of Jesus making a presentation of who He is by what He does. Because in the midst of forgiving the sins of the paralytic, the theologians present, and by the way, the theologians present in this scene get it right. They ask the question, who can forgive sins but God alone? It's a perfectly appropriate observation. And Jesus responds by saying, in effect, that you might know that the Son of Man has authority on earth to forgive sins, I say to you, get up and walk. And the assumption is that Jesus has the authority to forgive sins, but that He can't act unless God is with Him in the acting. So there are two things going together. There's the declaration of the individual authority of Jesus in the right to forgive sins, but then there's the assumption that God must be present in the action in order for that forgiveness, in order for that miracle to be performed. There was a belief in Judaism that God didn't help a sinner who violated the law. So when you get a Sabbath healing, like you do in John 9, or you get a healing with regard to forgiveness of sins, like in Mark 2, or you get the woman who's cleansed, exercised of a demon in Luke chapter 13, what you're getting is the emphasis of Jesus' authority over the Sabbath. You know, that incident involving the woman is an interesting one because Jesus makes the point, what in the midst of the objection, you should come back tomorrow and be healed. What more appropriate day for someone to be released from the bonds of Satan than the Sabbath? Jesus is showing that He is Lord of the Sabbath by the way He's handling that particular day. Jesus is showing He is Lord over the forgiveness of sins by having the authority to forgive sins, something that only God can do. And so what we are seeing in this intensification of the Torah is not only the intensification of the Torah in relationship to how it works relationally, but we're also seeing the authority of Jesus to be able to talk about how the law works or to talk about how sin works, which also is something that's evidenced as well in the associations that He makes. The way in which He handles His association with sinners assumes a certain level of authority about the way in which He conducts Himself. That's very, very important in perceiving who Jesus is. So these various challenges of the Jewish context are actually not so much challenges in the sense of a rejection of what the law represents. It actually pictures an embrace of the law and an intensification of the law in terms of taking it where the law should have been going all along. And in that, we see Jesus a renewed emphasis on how the promises of God and the law of God come together. We read the law not merely as stipulations, but we read the law in pointing to the promise. And with the coming of the promise, we have the establishment of a righteousness and a justice and a peace and a way of relating that shows what God was about when He made us in His image. When we think about the way in which Jesus has intensified the Torah and we bring together the picture of the miracles that are a part of the Sabbath healings, we also see another dimension to Jesus' teaching that is very important, and that is, what is it that Jesus is about in terms of who it is that he's standing in opposition to? One of the discussions that comes in the historical Jesus conversation is, who is it that Jesus is actually operating and pushing back against? Is he pushing back against Rome? Is he challenging the emperor? Is there a social and political dimension to what Jesus does? Now, the short answer to that question is yes. There is a social and political dimension to what it is that Jesus is doing. But his main target is not Rome. His main target is Satan, and his main target is the spiritual world that is out there, which itself has permeated this world. And so we see him saying things as when he heals the woman on the Sabbath. What more important day for someone who has been bound by Satan to be released than the day of the Sabbath? We don't see Jesus going to places like Sepphoris or Tiberias, which are the most powerful cities in the Galilean region. No, we see him in the countryside. We don't see him taking on Rome directly or engage in a lot of what we might call political rhetoric. No, he's talking about how people live in relationship to their neighbors and those kinds of questions. So we see a battle that involves Jesus against larger spiritual forces. The whole movement into Jesus' ministry, where he moves from the baptism immediately to face a temptation in which the challenges come from Satan, show the same thing. When he says things like, if I cast out demons by the finger of God, then the kingdom of God has come against you. We see that the battle that he is raging and the battle that he is waging is not against Rome, but against Satan and the spiritual forces that he is contending against. So the kingdom is portrayed as arriving. It's not just future. It resides in authority that he possesses. It's an authority that he possesses in relationship to the Torah. It's an authority that he possesses in relationship to sin. It's an authority that he possesses in relationship to the well-being of people. And the forces that he is pushing against are not merely social political forces, although there are ramifications and implications in that direction. The forces that he's pushing against are the spiritual forces that try and direct people not to live in the way that they're designed and direct people not to live in a way that reflects in a healthy way the image of God, but is pulling them in a counter direction. In other words, the battle for the kingdom of God and the battle for the hearts of people is a battle not about politics, but about persons and about how they relate to God and how they relate to one another.